This is particularly true for Americans because traditionally we are reluctant to spend lives and blood needlessly. And we will substitute vast amounts of national economic resources to achieve victory by technology on the battlefield. That's our way of fighting wars. We're highly mechanized. We'll put machines and we'll spend money, but we will try to save the lives of our troops and blood. The part of the reason why we as a nation are so enamored with military technology is that often eventual spin-offs in the civilian sector occur. We can all think of examples how recent wars accelerated scientific progress and applied technology, and the resulting developments were easily integrated into our society. Well, if you go back to World War II, we've got radar, the jet engine, penicillin, things like that. And up until recently, the aviation sector, for example, was driven by the military. The reason we had jet aircraft in the 1960s was that the Air Force had jet bombers, but the aerial tankers that they had to refuel them were propeller-driven. They were going as fast as they could. They stay in the sky to refuel the bombers. The bombers were flying as slow as they could and trying to refuel, and it was just a mess. So what they did, they developed a jet fuel transporter. That became the Boeing 707, the commercial version of that. And that's the way the military technology gets transferred over to the civilian sector. And the same thing is happening, except now the military is driving a lot of the development, and it eventually gets transferred back to the civilian sector if it's applicable. But you can't do that with certain things like tanks and bullets and bombs and all that. Okay, the limitations of official military budget estimates. Even when the direct economic costs are considered, and estimates of a particular war's cost are made by government economic forecasters, such as the Government Accounting Office, the GAO, the Congressional Budget Office, the CBO, or even the Office of Management and Budget, OMB, they are often greatly underestimated. Furthermore, these cost estimates and the eventual final compiled cost data on the war only include the federal budget costs for direct military spending and do not include post-war costs such as veterans benefits, health care, survivors benefits, and a host of other indirect costs such as post-war casualties that can continue on for decades after the war is over, period. When the real indirect costs of a war and other defense-related costs such as veterans benefits are included over an extended period of time, several decades or even a century, the total cost of a war are, as a rule of thumb, twice the original reported cost. So when they say World War II cost $4.5 trillion, I look at it, that's a $9 trillion figure to me. They say the Vietnam War cost $150 billion, $300 billion plus minimum, okay? Twice the cost of what the reported cost is. The reason is longevity of people. Like, we'll be paying for the Vietnam veterans' benefits up to the end of the 22nd century, okay? The last Civil War beneficiaries were paid in 1936, okay? 1936. And even some War of 1812 survivors were being paid in the early part of the 20th century. Same with the War of 1848 and so on. These things hang around for a long time. Some of the older veterans can attest to that, okay? Secondly, the Department of Defense budgetary process is extremely complicated and difficult to track. I think many of you already agree with me on that. There are so many different layers of budgeting, coupled with the fact that not all military spending is included in the DoD budget, presents a whole set of problems for our democracy. Christopher Hellman, a senior analyst for the Center for Defense Information, has researched the annual defense budget process and exposes a number of rather arcane myths about what the DoD budget actually pays for. Okay, people think it pays for everything, wars and peacekeeping operations and all that. It just doesn't do that. First and most important is that the defense budget does not pay for wars. Wait a minute. What do we have the Department of Defense for? Don't they pay for the wars, or they fight the wars? Yeah, they fight the wars. They got the equipment. Don't pay for individual wars. You want those, you got to go somewhere else. There is a simple and valid reason for this. It takes the Defense Department and Congress over 2 years to develop and pass a one-year budget. So they're working 2 years in advance on the single-year budget, okay? You simply can't anticipate that far in advance unexpected events such as war that will require federal funds. Federal law provides mechanisms for funding these unanticipated requirements outside the normal budget process in the form of supplemental appropriations. That's where you hear President Bush going to Congress saying, we need $76 billion to prosecute the Iraq war that we're fighting right now. Well, take it out of the Defense Department budget. No, that's already committed. We need all that for bombs and bullets and soldiers' pay and so on. So we have to get supplemental information or supplemental funding for that. So while the public perception is that the military operations in Iraq and Afghanistan necessitate a higher annual defense budget, this is simply not the case. We don't need higher defense budgets. We just need the supplemental fundings to be accurate and to comply with all the costs of the war. Another common myth, according to Hellman, is that our military spending enhances homeland security. We've heard this argument a lot since 9/11. Homeland Security is a responsibility of state and local governments and federal agencies outside the Defense Department, such as the FBI, FEMA, and the Coast Guard. Certain other activities, such as developing counterterrorist programs, weapons and strategies, and flying air defense combat patrols over the United States, are part of the DOD responsibility and account for roughly $10 billion annually, or 3% of the fiscal year 04 defense budget. However, flying domestic air patrols over American cities are a new function for the Department of Defense and cost roughly $2 billion annually. As a point of reference, patrolling the no-fly zones in Iraq since 1991 were estimated to cost $4 million a day, just for taking care of that. And this represents, in my personal opinion, a new form of continuous air warfare, and it's something that we can't afford indefinitely. We have a precedent for this going back into the 50s and 60s, where we had something called Operation Looking Glass, where we actually kept a B-52 bomber in the air all the time with nuclear weapons. In case everything on the ground got destroyed, they would fly to Russia and destroy them. And imagine that, the cost, operating cost, year, day after day, year after year, to keep a plane like a B-52 in the air, $7,000 an hour to operate and so on. And one rather specious argument used ad nauseum by advocates of increased defense budgets is that there are some logical connection between the size of the American economy and the size of the defense budget, that defense is entitled to some share, or particular share, of the overall economy. Like the Defense Department should have its piece. If the economy is going up, the Defense Department should go up. It's a specious argument. The advocates of growth in the defense budget will show you just one graph, the percentage of gross domestic product for defense over time. They will show defense spending at 10.8% in 1955, right at the end of the Korean War and the height of the Cold War, or 8.1% in 1970, or 6.1% in 1985. Today, the percentage of GDP for defense is a puny 3.3%. But it's a bigger pie. We have a $9 trillion economy as opposed to a $150 billion economy, so the percentage is going to be distorted and skewed. And you have to watch out when they do this on the evening news, and you know, statistics lie and damn lies and so on. It's real hard for the average citizen to figure this stuff out. So I think our organization could be the interpreters for that. You know, if you get yourself schooled on this topic and tell your local media that you know about this, and when they have a question, give you a call, and you'll give them the right skinny or find it for them, okay? That gives us credibility. Okay. The traditional watchdog institutions, such as the legislative branch of government, journalism, special interest, and citizens groups, are often at a loss on how to interpret much of this budgetary information for the general public. They don't know economics or anything. I mean, they're mile wide and inch deep. What you need sometimes is the people who are mile deep and an inch wide. As a result, we are in the mercy of the Pentagon's highly sophisticated propaganda machine and their willing apostles and lobbyists. And unfortunately, we often accept their findings and arguments at face value without any debate or independent analysis. Many defense industry trade publications and other special interest groups publications willingly serve as grand translators for the general public. For example, the Air Force Association's annual review of the Air Force budget is hardly going to be critical of any increased spending in the Air Force budget, since they are advocates of a strong air and space power component of the national defense. And they represent a significant interest group, Air Force veterans and retired career officers, okay? And Air Force personnel. This is the same. This is true for all the other uniformed services as well. Army, Navy, they have their same kind of lobbyists. Since the end of World War II, enough historical factual evidence has surfaced to indicate that concerted efforts by the Pentagon at domestic propaganda and disinformation, along with the collusion of the major defense contractors, has occurred on numerous occasions. These guys have lied to us time and time again. And they've also consorted with each other before, lying to us time and time again. This has led the United States into wasting large sums of money on unnecessary weapons programs for threats that were more imaginary than real, and at worst, overinflated, leading the nation into a number of unsuccessful military adventures. The so-called bomber gap of the 1950s, you may recall, was fanned by the unfounded fear that the Soviets would have 600 to 700 long-range strategic bombers by 1960. What they actually had then was a force of 190 bombers, most of them antiquated. The U.S. had a superiority of at least 300 bombers at the time. During the so-called missile gap of the 1960s, the Soviets were supposed to have 500 to 1,000 ICBMs by 1961. Later, when it all shook out, we found out that they only had 10. These famous gaps of the Cold War years continued with the ABM gap and the hard target kill gap of the 1970s, followed by the Soviet military spending gap, and finally the laser gap of the 1980s with Dr. Teller and Reagan and Star Wars. Most of them found to be more illusionary than real. Now, what happens is, like an old Mark Twain quotation, you know, a lie or a myth can be halfway around the world by the time truth gets its boots on. That's the problem we're dealing with here. This stuff gets disseminated so quickly by an effective propaganda machine, we don't have any time to counteract it, and it's off the front page and out of the citizenship's awareness window. Okay. Today, the manipulation still continues, but at a much more sophisticated level. For example, the cost of treating Gulf War I-related injuries and illnesses is now at $2 billion a year. We'll find that in the Defense Department budget anywhere. That's what the Gulf War syndrome is costing us in indirect cost to the first war. More than one quarter of the veterans of that war are receiving benefits that to deal with service-related medical problems ranging from memory lapse and fatigue to cancer and birth defects in their children. These cost figures are not included in the $7.3 billion monetary cost of the first Iraq War, and the military establishment tried to downplay the significance of Gulf War syndrome to avoid being accused of any initial wrongdoing by exposing American troops to unnecessary risks. They're not our friends. I mean, they will not stand behind us when they turn their back, like Kipling said. Also not included are the follow-on costs, such as reconstruction aid, the cost of military occupation, peacekeeping forces, humanitarian assistance, and other tertiary or secondary indirect costs, such as the disruption of trade, post-war inflation, economic stability, instability on the home front and in the war zone, and all other areas which are difficult to predict. We went through the 1970s with the inflation of the Vietnam War, which led us to the crisis of the 1980s and the energy embargo and all of that. One scholar who I found in particular who has helped refocus attention on the economics of modern war in light of the current war in Iraq is a Yale economist by the name of William Nordhaus. He's the author of a study called The Economic Consequences of a War with Iraq. His study attempts to narrow the gap between miscalculations of previous war cost estimates and the wide disparity in economic forecasting about Iraq War II. He cites examples of faulty economic forecasts of previous wars in American history. For example, Abraham Lincoln, Secretary of Treasury, estimated that the direct costs of the war to the North would be $240 million, which amounted to about 7% of the GDP at the time. Okay? The actual cost to the North alone turned out to be $3.2 billion, or about 13 times the original estimated cost. The cost to the South was much greater, for most of its capital stock was destroyed and the output per worker was depressed for nearly a century. The South didn't become the new South until way into the 1950s and 60s. As a result of the indirect cost of the destruction of the Civil War, tore down the infrastructure completely. So we've witnessed this on our own soil, in our own history. You can imagine what it's going to be like in third world countries that don't have political democracy as a base to work on or coherent political and economic structures. Nordhaus also cites the Vietnam War as another example of gross underestimation of war cost. In recent times, the cost of the Vietnam War were grossly underestimated as the buildup occurred. The original budget projection of early 1966 underestimated the cost for the subsequent fiscal year by $10 billion, or about 1.5% of GDP. In assuming the war would end by June 1967, the Pentagon underestimated the total cost of the war by about 90%. The war, in fact, dragged on until 1973, and the total direct cost was in the range of $110 and $150 billion. The indirect costs were more difficult to gauge, but comprised inflation and economic security, civil unrest, and some have argued a growing disenchantment with authority and government in the United States. You know, what happened to the countercultural movement and all that. Now, this $150 billion figure, if you double that to $300 billion, I can still, after 12 years of doing the Vietnam War research, show you where that's really underestimated. You know, $5 billion alone were left behind in just unused equipment, ammunition, trucks, and jeeps, and planes. The Vietnamese had created helicopters. They didn't need them. They sold them on the world arms market for hard currency and so on. So every war has debris like that. As for the current Iraq War, fasten your seatbelts, okay? Even after humanitarian assistance has been sufficiently provided and a basic infrastructure service restored, the cost of maintaining peacekeeping operations will be astronomical. And this is part of the current debate today that they don't tell you the real cost of it. Based on the U.S. peacekeeping experiences in Bosnia, where we actually did this in recent times, okay? A country one-eighth the size with one-sixth the population of Iraq, a peacekeeping force of 50,000 NATO troops at a cost of $10 billion per year were required. Military experts estimate that a constabulary force of peacekeepers ranging from 75,000 to 200,000 will be needed in Iraq for an indefinite period ranging from 5 years up to 2 decades. And that's why they fired General Shishkili for. You know, he was bringing this stuff out saying, this is what we're really going to need, guys. You better gear up for it. Quiet, General. Take your retirement. The CBO estimates the cost being between $17 and $46 billion per year, or approximately $250,000 per peacekeeper per year. And this figure is at the low end of estimated costs for peacekeepers in Kosovo. It might actually underestimate the cost of the post-combat environment in Iraq if it's hostile, and its dangers resemble more of the West Bank than the Balkans. The Balkans are pretty pacified. I mean, they stopped the fighting, but, you know, what we got here in Iraq is something altogether different and requires a different level of intensity of conflict. Last month, in July, the Secretary of Defense argued that for Congress that the current Iraq war has doubled in cost from the estimated $2 billion per month last April to $3.9 billion per month. You probably all saw the headlines on that and say, oh, no, it's going up. 145,000 troops in the Iraq theater will cost approximately $48 billion per year at current force levels for an indefinite period, providing the combat does not escalate. So we're now in a war of attrition, a.k.a. low-intensity conflict, guerrilla war, or whatever. If this scenario of thousands of American troops in Iraq for decades sounds far-fetched, or ridiculous, oh, that can't be true, Mr. Farrell, I get the hawks all the time. Yeah, that's bull. They're not going to do that. I just tell them, you know, remember, no one at the outbreak of the Korean War in June 1950, for example, would have predicted that the United States would still be maintaining a substantial occupation force in South Korea for over half a century, okay? And it doesn't look any easier in Iraq and so on. Okay, cost. I've got it broken down so you can even take your special areas of interest if you want. Like, for example, nuclear weapons. Let's talk about them for a minute. Fun topic, right? One of the American people seemed to be putting back on the back burner in spite of all the threats by the administration. One area deserving special attention in war cost analysis is nuclear weapons. It's an area, unfortunately, that has attracted relatively little attention considering the vast amount of funds the United States has expended on nuclear weapons since World War II, and whose existence serves mainly as a questionable deterrent. Today, planners in the current Bush administration, Defense Department, are arguing to create a whole new arsenal of low-yield nuclear weapons that would be used as deep-penetrating weapons, such as the RNEP, what they call it, the Robust Nuclear Earth Penetrator. And if you go back and look at Victory Through Air Power, which was produced by Alexander Seversky at the end of World War II, he said Walt Disney made an animated version of what future air warfare would look like, and right there is a bunker-busting bomb. It'll go down to the bottom and blow everybody up underground, and it's an ancient concept. In my opinion, such consideration of the use of nuclear weapons of any size as a natural extension of conventional weapons is, of course, naive, irresponsible, unprecedented, and extremely dangerous to American domestic and foreign policy interests. That's a personal opinion. I don't go along with nuclear. Anybody who knows anything about nuclear weapons and knows how those work and what the after effects are. 1 pound of plutonium, 1 pound of plutonium, which we have a billion tons, you know, in the Earth, scattered around, not all unaccounted for, if properly placed in the atmosphere, would kill all of humanity with lung cancer. 1 pound. You know? So we're dealing with something really horrible here that people have forgotten about. It's not the blast, it's the residual radiation that's going to kill everybody if they don't stop messing around with these things. A landmark study published in 1998 by the Brookings Institution titled Atomic Audit, The Cost and Consequences of U.S. Nuclear Weapons Since 1940, is the most succinct and accurate summary of nuclear weapons cost to date. Nobody has done this. Nobody has done this. It's all been piecemeal. One of the major problems for researchers in this area, me included, is that neither the DOD nor the Atomic Energy Commission kept accurate records of spending on weapons research and acquisition and deployment during the 1950s. It was a shoebox system. They just ran it off a shoebox with colonels, and nobody knows what the money was spent on this. The Manhattan Project is all screwed up, and everything that we developed during the Red Scare from 48 to 51, first phase of the early Cold War years with nuclear technology, nobody can find an accurate cost accounting for any of that. So they've done some extrapolations and so on. Since 1940, the United States has spent almost $5.5 trillion in constant $96 on nuclear weapons and weapons-related programs. $5.5 trillion on nuclear weapons programs alone, okay? This figure, which is based on an unprecedented four-year analysis of historical budget data and were necessary conservative estimates of costs that either remain classified or not clearly apportioned to nuclear programs, does not include $320 billion in an estimated future year cost for storing and disposing more than five decades worth of accumulated toxic and radioactive waste, and $20 billion for dismantling nuclear weapon systems and disposing of surplus nuclear materials. It costs about $10,000 to $25,000 to take apart a nuclear bomb. It's in the inventory. Take it apart, but not disposing the plutonium core and any other toxic radioactive materials that go along with it. Those go to places like Hanford, Washington, and maybe Yucca Flats on the fault line and places like that in the future. So we don't know what to do with the first cupful of radioactive waste we've had from the Trinity explosion, from the first nuclear weapon. That stuff is still floating around, and it's unaccounted for, and I'll show you a place that you haven't even thought where it is. It'll scare you even more. When these amounts, at least of which are likely to exceed current official estimates, are factored in, the total incurred cost of U.S. nuclear weapons programs exceeds $5.8 trillion. That averages out to about $21,000 per person in the United States. That's what it costs per capita to take care of this problem. And they don't have the technology really solidified yet to do it right. And it's going to be the next two generations' major problem. It's not going to go away. It's going to get worse. And you can see why. The amount spent through 1996, $5.5 trillion, is 29% of all military spending from 1940 to 1996. 29% of all Defense Department spending, the budget, not the supplemental, has been used for nuclear weapons production, delivery systems, and so on. This figure is significantly larger than any previous official or unofficial estimate of nuclear weapons expenditures, exceeding all of the categories of government spending except non-nuclear national defense, $13.1 trillion for that same period, you know, from 1940 to 1996. Social Security only costs $7.9 trillion, and this figure amounts to almost 11% of all government expenditures from 1940 to 1996. 11% of all of our government expenditures has been for nuclear weapons. Okay? And we've only used them now twice. During this entire period from 1940 to 1996, too, the United States averaged really $98 billion a year on developing and maintaining its nuclear arsenal. You just don't create the bombs and put them in a bomb storage thing. They have to be, tritium gas has to be, you know, maintained. And there's a lot to nuclear weapons that didn't get in the popular press. According to the best estimates of the researchers in the Atomic Audit, the United States produced some 70,299 nuclear weapons of various design from 45 to 1990. Between the end of 1945 and the end of 1996, the United States spent some $644 billion developing and procuring weapon systems primarily to deliver strategic nuclear weapons. That is, the bombers and the ICBMs. This figure included 4,700 strategic bombers, which a lot of them we cut up out in Arizona, 3,160 ICBMs, or intercontinental ballistic missiles, 2,975 submarine-launched ballistic missiles, and procuring and retrofitting 59 ballistic missile submarines. Also included were a few experimental programs like the nuclear-powered aircraft. It actually took a B-36 bomber in the 50s, converted it to put a nuclear reactor aboard, fly it off, and create, you know, electricity in an airplane, thinking that they were going to use that to power the plane. I can imagine in today's air traffic environment, nuclear planes going down and crashing. It was a good idea way ahead of its time. Okay. Altogether, both direct and indirect costs, the United States spent some $1.9 trillion equipping, manning, operating, and supporting U.S. nuclear forces during this period. Depending on the type of weapon, the cost of dismantling a nuclear weapon today ranges from $10,000 to $25,000, and it doesn't include the cost of disposing of that toxic nuclear plutonium core. I have a surreal case study that I'll pass up here and get to something else. I once did a study in 1991. I'll tell you what it is real quick. Air Force wanted to get involved in Desert Storm, Iraq War I. They flew two cells of B-52s, seven aircraft, with converted cruise missiles. They took a $1.7 million missile, spent $300,000 on each one, converting them to carry a 1,000-pound warhead so they could fly 35,000 miles or whatever, no, 14,000 miles from Louisiana to Iraq, shoot these missiles off the targets and come back again. As long as combat mission in history, and it's based on a RAND study that I found. And it's in the material. You can read it. And it's sort of like, you read this, people won't believe it. It's just incredible. The bottom line of that is that the Air Force spends a lot of money. They're sort of like the golden combat arm. They require a lot of resources. But four of the missiles didn't go off. You know, I saved us $8 million there. The cruise missiles were inaccurate at times, and the cost of this operation did not include the backup support of aerial refueling tankers, fighter escort over hostile areas, and all kinds of other logistical things that go into this, you know. So it's an interesting case study, and I'll just leave it for you to play with. The netherworld, there is such a thing, between nuclear and conventional weapons is a scary one that we're all concerned about, and it's on the tips of everybody's mind today. The United States, in its technical prowess, has created a new generation of radioactive conventional weapons that could be classified somewhere between nuclear and conventional armaments that have devastating consequences for human beings and the environment. These, quote, dirty weapons are inexpensive. Depleted uranium, nuclear materials such as spent nuclear rods from nuclear power plants, reactors, and other sources. And if you all, I'll leave this, won't explain all the DU material that I've got here, but it's used for weapons like... This is a 30 millimeter round. It fits in the GAU cannon on the A-10 Warthog or Thunderbolt aircraft. We shot off 940,000 of these in Gulf War I. And the projectile, this is a training round, and the projectile core, there's a little steel spike that goes inside of this that serves as a penetrator. The ones in the depleted uranium have a big flange on them, and they weigh much more than this. And the weapon itself, the first cost estimates on these were $100 a round. They got them down to $9, but the average is about $15 a round. You know, and every F-18 carries 1,100 rounds and so on. But what happens is the depleted uranium, which is so hard and heavy, it hits the side of the tank. If it doesn't have depleted armor on the side of it, it fuses through and becomes liquid hot, goes inside, vaporizes, and splatters around like a hot shotgun shell, killing the crew. However, in the process of doing this, it emits a tremendous amount of radioactive dust that settles on everything, and that's what's caused the Gulf War syndrome. And there's a great book on this, if you're interested. It's called Medal of Dishonor, and there's a videotape that goes with it. We're going to have a presentation in our chapter just on this one some evening. Just talk about this so people get a better understanding of it. Medal of Dishonor. But the renowned international scientist, Dr. Helen Caldicott, who you all heard has been doing an outstanding job of doing work on trying to prevent the spread of nuclear weapons, she says the United States has conducted two nuclear wars, the first against Japan in 1945 and the second in Kuwait and Iraq in 1991. She says that, you know, because of what we've done, it violates the indiscriminate weapons clause of the United Nations Treaty and so on, that we're actually, instead of having the big mega blast, you know, flattens everything, kills everybody in all well fell swoop, we're just doing it one round at a time. You know, we're just spreading the pollution, and we're starting to see the effect on birth defects and health hazards, and we've got GIs that got 5,000 times the amount of radioactivity in their liver that they're supposed to have, and there's all kinds of health things, and that Medal of Dishonor should be required reading for all BFP members. Okay, let's talk about the real weapons of mass destruction real quickly. Conventional weapons, okay? They're the ones that do all the killing, you know. It's the atomic bomb wasn't the real big invention of World War II that killed everybody. It was the proximity fuse on artillery rounds that let you crank in the numbers and let the round explode over the heads of troops or get down to ground level and so on. Artillery was a real decimator of humanity and civilians in World War II. And artillery is still the same way today. It's the artillery that kills the people. That's why we've got all these tank battalions and armor divisions and so on. It's just extension of mobile artillery. Okay, you think about that for a minute. It makes sense. Who kills more? Nagasaki or Hiroshima? Hiroshima with 146,000 total casualty. Now that's the Western Front in 2 weeks fighting, you know, or Eastern Front in 2 weeks fighting. Modern conventional weapon war today ranges from low-intensity conflict, we've heard that term thrown around, everything from guerrilla warfare, all the way across the spectrum to high-intensity land warfare, like the near-nuclear warfare we witnessed recently in Iraq. We've really thrown a lot of firepower around the last 10 years to justify our technology. New technologies and threats are driving the American military doctrine into new areas such as non-lethal weaponry. They got now bullets that will just disarm you and not kill you, you know. And asymmetrical warfare, where we do different kinds of things. You know, you send in the CIA groups instead of a battalion and so on. There's all kinds of things in the doctrine that you might want to look at. This is partially the result of the post-World War II and Cold War years, which left the world awash in conventional weapons, and as the U.S. armed potential allies whose regimes were not stable. We gave all this stuff away, we sold all this stuff, and you could still get it, and it still fuels our economy tremendously. In fact, one could make the argument that real weapons of mass destruction are not the chemical and biological and nuclear weapons humankind has created, but rather the old-fashioned guns, bombs, and bullets that have been responsible and continue to cause most of all the deaths of modern war. The problem with conventional war is the relatively low cost and easy accessibility of military weapons has led to a brisk trade in the arms market that many small nations can't afford to participate, but nonetheless try, resulting in greater indebtedness and instability, period. Any nation or subnational group with enough will and wallet can amass a conventional arsenal of significant firepower, mainly from the United States and a few other nations who gladly serve as the world's armorer. However, until recently, armed groups such as terrorists represented very little threat to the well-armed nation state like the United States. That's no longer the case. Asymmetrical warfare is changing to the point now where, you know, what's the difference if you have a formalized military unit of a battalion of 1,000 troops that are trained and so on, or you've got a 25 guerrillas over here with the same amount of firepower with religious fanaticism, and they're going after this different objectives. That one's harder to stop, obviously. You can stop this one with military force. You know, they're formal. These guys are informal. With the never-ending spiraling cost of weapons technology and advancement, the acquisition cost of new weapons is rapidly becoming the purview of the privileged few, nations who are able to buy them from an even smaller, more privileged group of nations, in which the United States is the leader, who are able to develop and manufacture such weapon systems. Secondly, the cost to project conventional military power with its extensive logistics needs over vast distances is exorbitant except for a very few nation states possessing such a capability. The world hasn't shrunk anymore. It's still the same size. We can get things faster there, but we pay a tremendous price for it in logistics costs. And I'll give you some really startling examples that you can use in just a moment. Environmental damage, the unresolvable problem. There are other aspects of war besides just, you know, humanity and civilization. While there are a number of other aspects of nuclear and conventional weapons cost to consider, such as massive expenditures for delivery systems, one area of note seems to elude public scrutiny is the environmental damage and the extreme risk to humanity, nuclear weapons and conventional weapons, and their accumulated hazardous waste pose for the future. Modern wars take place at rapid speeds, and they are fought with air power and large mechanized ground forces that can quickly traverse vast distances, leaving a trail of indiscriminate destruction and environmental damage in their wake. The increased frequency with which inhumane weapons, or what the United Nations call weapons of indiscriminate effect, are now being used by the nations of the world, pose long-term threats to the environment. In fact, depleted uranium is now in the arsenals of 15 armies in the world. 15 armies have depleted uranium weapons. Now, how are you going to get control on that? You know, look at what we try to do with this nuclear proliferation. Now these guys have got 20-millimeter rounds all the way up to 120-millimeter tank rounds. And, oh, we're going to have inspections on those? Well, how you can hide those things anywhere? You know, they're small, little, and leak very little radiation. Incendiary weapons such as napalm, fuel and air explosives like the new 10-ton Belu-118S, the thermobaric bomb named the Massive Ordnance Air Blast Bomb, or the mother of all bombs, is replaced the daisy cutters from the Vietnam era. These degrade the environment long after their use. You know, it's what they, you know, when you use daisy cutters for, the big Belu-82 in Vietnam, instant landing zone. Come up in a jungle, you drop this thing from a big helicopter or a C-130, and it's a 10-ton blast. That's what it was. It made a 10-ton crater. But also kills by concussion. Not just blow everything away, but it kills the earthworms down to a couple hundred feet and so on. And if there's anybody in caves, they're going to be killed by the concussion effect as well. Well, the new MOAB is 21,000 pounds. Does the same thing, except it's guided by GPS. I mean, you could put it in somebody's window if you want to. It's that precise. So they've just got through testing that in March, and I haven't been able to find out if they've used it in Iraq or Afghanistan yet, but I just bet they have, and they're not telling anybody. Somebody would notice a big, big blast somewhere. Fuel air explosives are just like a gas stove going off in your house. You drop the bomb, the canister opens up, fuel and air mixture around, makes a big cloud. They detonate a cloud at a certain point, and blam, everything blows away. These are smaller incendiary weapons. The Air Force and the military said, oh, we don't use napalm anymore. We've taken it out of our inventory. We have a new version. Instead of gasoline, napalm is really aluminum soaps, styrofoam, and petroleum jelly. It's a gelled mixture, and you blow it up, and the styrofoam goes out, and it sticks on your skin. And they also put magnesium in it, so it burns right through. It doesn't stop burning. Now we have we take the gasoline out and put in kerosene, and that's our new firebomb. We don't call it napalm anymore. It's a firebomb. Big distinction, semantics. So when you see that kind of stuff, you know, you got to really look at what they're doing and who says what. Okay, environmental damage. Here's another problem. Anti-personnel weapons such as landmines, cluster bombs, and their high percentages of dead or unexploded rounds, even depleted uranium rounds, can cause damage decades after they're deployed because of their vast numbers. The increasing number of casualties, especially to children in third world countries, caused by unexploded ordnance, landmines, cluster munitions, is well documented and has generated public awareness as well as a worldwide demand for prosthetic devices in these countries. You know, people's arms and legs are getting blown off, and you know, we come in there with prosthetic devices to repair them. Like that C-130, or that 130 30-millimeter round, if that doesn't go off, it just stays in the ground. But, you know, go off any time. Kid hits it with a – farmer hits it with a plow or something, and boom. How long this can actually happen or occur? The old World War I and World War II battlefields of Europe still claim victims of unexploded ordnance to the point where countries like France maintain a corps of specially trained explosive experts called démineurs to defuse the occasional World War I artillery shell unearthed by the unsuspecting farmer with his tractor and plow. And a lot of them have been killed by that. And imagine what it's going to be like in places like Laos and Vietnam, or places where we just seeded the countryside with those weapons indiscriminately. The cluster bomb units are just especially abhorrent. The military polluting of the oceans. Probably the most egregious and underreported example of environmental damage done by the military has been to the oceans through accidents. According to one study, the world's navies have had over 1,276 accidents between 1945 and 1988. 799 of these have involved U.S. naval ships. These accidents have run the gamut from fires, collisions, ship and submarine sinkings, and explosions to lost nuclear weapons and the sinking of nuclear reactors. The Greenpeace organization funded this study, and I've got it here with me if you want to take a look at it. Naval accidents 1945 to 1948, or 1988, calculated there are at least 50 nuclear warheads and 9 nuclear reactors lying on the ocean floor. It could be said that the world's 6th largest nuclear power after the United States, the former Soviet Union, France, the United Kingdom, and China is the Deep Blue Sea. All that stuff is lingering. And here's the really tragic part. The cumulative and ongoing damage to the world's ocean over time from these accidents is unpredictable and incalculable. The technology for recovery and cleanup of these radioactive waste from the ocean's depths does not yet exist. That's going to be a real problem. The first time we have a nuclear explosion that irradiates a large section of, you know, a beach or something like that, it's going to make that place inhabitable for a long period of time. And the cost of building and maintaining a nuclear and conventional blue water fleet like the United States is also prohibitive for both nations, for most nations. The American Navy, for example, has 12 aircraft carriers in its fleet. Beyond the $4.5 billion construction cost to build one carrier and in the operating cost of $208 million a year, which averages out to $569,000 a day to operate one of these things, it's not the total cost. The carrier is supported by a host of planes, helicopters, submarines, and escort and supply vessels that comprise the task force necessary to protect and sustain the highly vulnerable carrier while at sea. The annualized cost of a carrier plus its supporting task force is $1.5 billion a year, just to keep one of the 12 carrier task force in operation, or about $43,600,000 a day, or $18 million an hour, according to the GAO. And an aircraft carrier task force can consume up to 5,000 tons of supplies in one day. So you've got to get the stuff to these guys, okay? Now, earlier this year, our President George W. Bush tied up one of these carrier task force, the USS Abraham Lincoln, for at least a couple of hours, just 30 miles off the coast of San Diego, for a highly dramatized landing on the Abraham Lincoln's flight deck. In clearly what was a political stunt for the media and domestic morale, okay? The mission accomplished, you remember that? That cost about close to $19 million. I think that's okay. I think the Department of Defense should invoice the Republican Party for $19 million for the cost of it. If they show one frame of that as a political commercial, okay? Because that's misusing the privilege, the rank and privilege, and, you know, all that other stunts that goes along with it. If just like the movie companies, if you want to use the Department of Defense, you've got to pay them to use their equipment and their soldiers and stuff like that. I don't think the political party should be exempt from that. And I think we put an end to all that foolishness. And what would $19 million do in your community? You know, and you know we're going to see that footage over and over and over again as the Tom Cruise wannabes and whatever. Real quickly, conventional land warfare. Since World War II, land battles in modern war have turned entire countries into battle zones. That may seem obvious to us, but for somebody who's come from the previous generation, it's not so obvious. The massive destructive force of modern weapons dispersed over large geographical areas has become the norm. In previous historical eras, the battlefield was somewhat a restricted area. Mechanized warfare and air power have geometrically expanded the killing zone. To sustain these forces requires an enormous logistics infrastructure, creating additional environmental consequences. In fact, it's the logistics that really chew up the budget tremendously. And I'll give you some examples of that. Logistics still remains the critical and most costly element in modern war. As Napoleon said in the 19th century, an army marches on its stomach. A division during his time, the Franco-Prussian War of 1870, needed only about 50 tons of food and fodder a day for their food for the troops, fodder for the animals, okay? In 1916, during World War I, this number had increased to 150 tons due to the increased use of artillery, machine guns, and other sophisticated weapons of the day. And that was during a period of technological stalemate, where both sides had equal weaponry and they were just trying to dislodge each other. By World War II, about 300 tons a day were consumed by American forces in North Africa, while Allied planters expected to spend 650 tons per day per division in France. One division in World War II used 650 tons of supply per day. So you had to keep the pipelines going. One armored division today, consisting of 14,000 to 16,000 troops, hundreds of vehicles, 300 of which are heavy Abrams armored tanks, and a huge logistical tail, represents a substantial environmental hazard even as it moves before engaging in combat. An American armored division can consume some 3,000 tons of supplies today and over 600,000 gallons of fuel per day and rarely can travel more than 100 kilometers. 600,000 gallons of fuel per day for one division, okay? One division, a few divisions make up a corps, a few corps make up an army, okay? And they can rarely traverse that distance because of breakdowns, which will average 100 or more over that distance. So they're very fragile, these tanks. They're not as what we see on television. In contrast, during World War II, Patton's entire Third Army required 350,000 gallons of fuel per day. An entire army, not one division, not a corps, but a whole army. Now, what he had to do, the Special Logistics Unit, of fuel trucks formed to deliver the fuel to the rapidly advancing Third Army in France and Germany. They created the Red Ball Express. You've heard of the famous Red Ball Express. Trucks going from the D-Day landing front, where the fuel was offloaded, driving across France and catching up with Patton's army to give them fuel to keep going forward. Now, the Red Ball Express, their trucks alone needed 300,000 gallons a day to deliver the 350,000 gallons that Patton needed, okay? So you see what we're talking about here? It's worse today. What we never see on television, we see the tanks going around and shooting up, and we see the front end. They ought to just take the cameras and turn them 180 degrees so you see those hundreds of vehicles, the munitions carriers, the water carriers, the fuel carriers, and the troops, the medics, the Humvees. It's a 5,000-vehicle parade. A typical armor division is 5,000 vehicles, one vehicle for every three troops. And I once took my wife to Fort Carson when I was out there for a conference. I was stationed there in the Army. It was when the 4th Infantry Division was headquartered there. My stepson was middle high school age. He thought this was cool. And I said, this is what an armored division looks like. And we just row after row, you know, block after block of vehicles. And I said, this one costs this much, this costs this much. And they got to take this whole thing, and they got to send it somewhere, like Kuwait or at that time, because they all had chocolate chip covering on them and so on. She started to see the picture then. But, you know, not everybody gets a chance to see this in the flesh. You see it on TV, and it's miniaturized. It's distorted. It's not real. And you actually drove through one of these parks and say, oh, my God, and how many divisions do we have, and how much does it cost? And I'll give you the shocking part. I'm sorry I've saved this for now. Besides the initial acquisition cost and manpower, a mechanized infantry division costs about $4 billion per year for equipment, training, operations, support, and overhead. So it's about the same cost as an aircraft carrier. $4 billion for an aircraft carrier, just to buy it and build it. $4 billion to set up an armor division. The unit cost of a 60-ton M1A1 Abrams tank, for example, is about $3.6 million. You can find figures all over the place, depending on how they are, but it's about 3.6, as close as I can calculate. The operating cost per mile for one Abrams tank is, how much do you get per mile? 35 cents a gallon, or 35 cents a mile for travel and all that sort of, whatever that is, $159.74 a mile. You drive an Abrams tank 1 mile, it costs $159.74. Why? Well, I'll tell you why, okay? It averages about 4 gallons to the mile for openers, okay? I mean, not 4 miles to the gallon, four gallons to the mile. 60-ton piece of equipment, moving a mile, it takes 4 gallons of fuel. So behind that tank, you see sometimes in World War II, they had barrels strapped on the back, fuel barrels and so on. There's a big 3,000-gallon tanker truck following along, protected by Humvees and so on, and they just got a stream of those for each of those tanks, you know. So that's the one cost of it. Although a formidable weapon, the Abrams, however, is a very delicate machine with stark limitations. It's transported to the battlefront on heavy equipment transport trucks in order to save the fuel and wear and tear on the engine and its tracks. The tracks break down all the time. And you don't see them, they don't jump off at the port and start steaming off on their own. They put them on these big flatbed trucks and they tow them, and usually they're contracted in country. You got some Arabic driver driving this American tank along this substandard road to get as close as they can to the battle zone, then they offload it, okay? The British created this idea in World War II, and we picked it up. Now, we have our own AGTs, but very often we contract that in-country. Now, it says something about the tanks, doesn't it? They can only go so far before breaking down, and the breakdown costs are expensive, et cetera, et cetera. So the idea that we're going to go blazing away in the desert is a big myth. The media image of battalions of M1A1 Abrams tanks racing across the desert at 40 miles an hour en route to Baghdad, 120-millimeter cannons blazing away at enemy tanks and other targets of opportunity up to 2 miles away, is not entirely accurate. Okay? What's missing from this picture is the massive multi-billion-dollar rear columns of support troops, vehicles, food, fuel, water, ammunition carriers, maintenance equipment that make up the logistical tail. And every American soldier requires 6 pounds of food and 20 pounds of water per day in combat. So in addition to bringing up the gasoline, you've got to bring up the food and the water and the ammunition and take back the wounded and all that sort of thing. So it's really an expensive, expensive operation when you're talking about this. Nobody talks about it. Yes?
Do we leave a lot of the Abrams tanks behind?
No. We do something stupider than that. Leaving behind would be smart. They got the tanks from the United States and Europe where they were painted green for the forest of Northern Europe to fight the Soviets, okay? They bring them to Saudi Arabia and they spray paint them desert sand. The paint costs $60 a gallon, okay? $60 a gallon, a couple gallons of paint each tank and other equipment. And then they fight the war, come back, demobilize, and then nobody writes about this, what they call Operation Stand Down, where they took all the stuff from Desert Storm 1 that they didn't use. The Saudis made them take it out of the country, so we had to wash it all off, clean all the uranium dust off of it and everything, took the tanks and repainted them green again and sent them back to Germany and the United States. Yeah. And so we paint them $60 a gallon, then repaint them back to the original color to go to their bases. That's the height of idiocy, okay? But that's another whole story. Nobody ever talks about the backside of logistics. They always talk about getting the stuff to the troops. But when the troops don't use it, in World War II, we threw the stuff overboard, and left it there and all that. They don't do that now. They bring it back. I forget how many, close to 250,000 tons of ammunition alone were brought back from Desert Storm 1. And I'll tell you what that stuff cost to ship in a moment. Okay. So in most media accounts of the war, we are rarely told the true operating cost of these high-tech weapon systems is what I'm getting at, okay? When the occasional unit cost or operating cost statistic is cited, is often misunderstood, erroneous, or even deliberately distorted. They actually distort some of these figures. This plane cost this much because we bought it back in 1987. That's what we paid for it. That's what it cost. But if we had to replace it today, it would cost us twice that much, but they don't say that, okay? Okay, finally, air power. This is the elite golden combat arm. It's the most expensive combat arm. Throughout the 1920s, up to the end of World War II, a national mythology grew up around the doctrine of air power in the United States to make other forms of land combat obsolete. Air power was going to make future ground wars and land armies unnecessary by being able to totally destroy the enemy's ground forces from the air tactically, while at the same time, strategic air power was going to strike at the industrial heart of the enemy, destroying his capacity to wage war. This is all the stuff that you come out of World War II with. Of course, they don't tell you that only 20% of the bombs hit the target, and it was mostly making toothpicks out of forests, and they just weren't precision, all the way up until Vietnam. It sounded good in theory, but a lot of tax dollars were spent on the development of air power, especially during World War II. Air power fit well in America's traditional reliance on technological solutions to military problems. Flying directly into the heart of the enemy and destroying him supported America's historical reluctance on high casualties and bloodshedding. Unfortunately, this myth did not live up to its proponents' predictions. As we could see the wars in the second half of the 20th century, Korea and Vietnam, air power alone could not secure the battlefield, eliminate the war-fighting capability of a non-industrialized country whose military systems, troop needs, and logistical infrastructure were well below the threshold of interdiction by American air power, no matter how massively supplied. Now, I had a startling example of this. I went to Vietnam in 1998 with a group of POWs, former pilots who were shot down, and we were driving from Hanoi up to the Cao Bang area up in northern China, near the Chinese border. And as we were leaving Hanoi, we got about 5-10 miles outside. If you notice something about the countryside, we were looking and talking, there's the Vietnamese people and so on. You notice we've had a steady stream of people from Hanoi to where we are now, and they're still going on. You can't interdict that with air power. All you have to do is to stop them what they're carrying and make them carry bullets and food and so on, and you've got the Ho Chi Minh Trail. And there's nothing you can do to interdict that. The same was through in the Korean War. Chinese divisions, North Vietnamese divisions, they require the same amount of tonnage per division as Napoleon's army did, 50 tons a day. And you can't interdict a power unless you go to genocide, okay? You start killing them all. So you can't interdict these third world logistical systems, especially if they're fighting in their home area in geographical advantage. Now, the Arabs are a different case in point. The Afghans, maybe, but the Iraqis, no. There's no place to hide. So the army says, we don't do jungles anymore. We're just doing deserts where they can use their armor, high power concentrations of firepower to destroy the enemy. Okay, the introduction of nuclear weapons and the slow evolution of delivery systems from manned bombers to ICBMs kept the air power doctrine alive during the Cold War. Unable to use nuclear weapons for anything else than other expensive deterrent, during the Cold War years, attempts were made to use nuclear weapons against our enemies were recommended by the military in the 1950s. These are hard to document, but they're there. And I found them in secondary sources, but I've only had a chance to go to D.C. once, to the National Archives, to see the original documents. Two times, of course, during the Battle of Dien Bien Phu, we had a thing called Operation Vulture, where the French wanted us to come in and put tactical nuclear weapons around Dien Bien Phu, kill the Viet Minh army that was attacking them. Eisenhower said, no, that'd start World War III. The Chinese are crazy. We don't want to do that. The French said, oh, you won't help us with our national interests. So they pull out of NATO later after they lose in Algeria, and they go back and build their own nuclear force called the Force de Frappe. They also built an aircraft carrier from the keel up for the first time. France says to us, well, if you're not going to do this for us, we're going to have to do this for ourselves. And the arms race starts exploding because we didn't use nuclear weapons in support of an ally. Another example was in 1954 was the critical year. Thank goodness Eisenhower was president because he was a military man and he was a sensible person. What Eisenhower did in the 1950s, the Defense Department had the think tanks and everything else like they've got today, the Wolfowitz types, and they were saying, if we don't nuke the Soviet Union and China by 1954, they're going to have enough nuclear capability to launch a first strike against the United States. And what's that mean? That means that they could launch a first strike, destroy us, and we can retaliate against them and kill them all, okay? And we didn't want them to have first strike capability. So what happened was they proposed a September deadline, and Eisenhower said, no, we're not going to do this. We're not going to launch a preemptive first strike on somebody with nuclear weapons. It's just not a way civilized nations conduct international diplomacy. You know, we're not going to be a preemptive nation. Today, we're talking about preemptive strikes at small levels, okay? So keep that in mind. We have a history where we resisted that in the past when the military has advocated we need to do this and wiser heads prevailed, okay? The situation is repeating itself. I'm not saying that history repeats itself, but historical conditions do. And I think we're at one of those vital points now where historical conditions are repeating themselves. Okay, what happened in this particular event during the Cold War years is that, okay, we can't drop the nuclear weapons, we'll make the conventional weapons better. So they took conventional weapons and put all kinds of guidance systems on them in Vietnam and so on, and now we've got the smart bombs, only which 10% were dropped in Iraq War I, greater percentage in Iraq War II. The 1991 was the debut of this new doctrine. The Gulf War was acknowledged by the military as a testing ground for many of these new weapons and tactics as a way of giving new pilots combat experience. Historically, this argument to me is reminiscent of the old Spanish Civil War in 1936, where Guernica served as a testing ground for the new blitzkrieg tactics of Hitler's Luftwaffe and Wehrmacht, first use of strategic bombing. You know, so they had to have a testing place to test their power. That's what's Iraq and Vietnam, and all those to us, the same sort of thing. For every hour of flight you have, there's hundreds of hours of ground maintenance and other kinds of cost involved. A typical fighter-bomber sortie, you know, you see them taken off from the carrier, and so that's $500,000 right there, every time they fly one of those. A sortie is a mission to target and back again. By the time you do wear and tear, a typical division will need 300 sorties of support per day. So it means, you know, 100 aircraft flying, 3 sorties a day is about the max of what they can do. And they require several hundred tons of equipment at their air bases to support them, fuel, ammunition, everything else to support the ground troops. So that infrastructure has got to be in place well in advance before the ground troops go in, okay? The complexity of engines and electronic equipment, today's modern fighter carries about a ton of sophisticated electronic equipment that breaks down a lot, and you have to have a crew of technicians just working on that alone, and on and on. The B-2 bomber, I have a section here I'll save for you later that you can read on your own about how they lied to you about the cost on that and how that was supposed to work. It's the last of the man-bomber concept, we hope, unless they start wanting to use them for tactical situations, dropping iron bombs for indefinitely, standoff platforms. And I'd like to just say, close with one last word on logistics, if I could, okay? Because this is the thing I think it really drives you up the wall. Another misconception fanned by the media in Hollywood is that American military units are swiftly flown overseas to a war zone with everything they need to hit the ground fighting. And you see the troops getting off the plane with their packs on. Let's go to war. Most of the logistics and material needed for modern war are still transported by sea, according to the U.S. Transportation Command, which coordinates American troop and cargo movements. On any given day, more than 120 U.S. ships are packed with supplies on the seas for troops. Transporting soldiers and equipment to Iran costs $7.1 billion. Last January, the United States sent only 7,250 tons of cargo to the Persian Gulf by air, an additional 550,000 tons, almost 80 times more, shipped by sea. A good deal of material for fighting in the Persian Gulf is stored in pre-positioned overseas storage depots that are part of U.S. military worldwide basing systems, done in collaboration with friendly governments, usually by a complex lease arrangement. Diego Garcia, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and so on. Of the 4,387 aircraft in the U.S. inventory, only one is capable of airlifting a 60-ton Abrams tank. Okay, it's a C-5A Galaxy, a heavy-lift strategic transport developed in the 1960s. And its troop-carrying counterpart, the Boeing 747, like Air Force One. Each of these consume about 12 tons of fuel per hour in flight. Okay, 12 tons. So a C-5A carrying a 60-ton tank will consume 84 tons of fuel just flying to Europe, where they have to land, refuel, and take the next leg to Iraq. From this small illustration, you can see it's impossible to airlift all troops, their weapons, ammunition, support equipment, vehicles, food, fuel, water to sustain a division, much less an army, over such vast distances for any period of time. Only one transportation alternative is available, the sea. As a result, the fact is that the world's sea lanes have to be defended and kept open for American strategic interests, necessitate the need for a large blue water navy to protect those sea lanes. We can't fight wars, no matter how glorious the Air Force is, unless we can keep the sea lanes open to provide the supplies for the planes and all. Now, without control of the seas, the U.S. simply cannot project and sustain its military power over vast distances. During the first Gulf War, we had to clean up and ship back to the U.S. and elsewhere around the world the war material we did not use, including hundreds of tons of ammunition, equipment, thousands of vehicles, all had to be cleaned. They set up four big, gigantic car washes. That's what they did. There was four of them. And they were working around the clock cleaning all this stuff so they could bring it back to the States or to other prepositioned areas, taking the decontaminants out of it and all that sort of thing. How successful they were, that's another question. Conclusion. This is it, and I'll be quiet. In conclusion, the foregoing is only intended as a general introduction to some of the cost implications of modern war. There are literally hundreds of other aspects about the economics of modern war that are not part of the public debate, but end up as part of the public debt. One interesting question arising from looking at modern war cost is that could America go to war as quickly and as frequently as it has in the past century if it did not have the vast arsenal it has built with so much of its national treasure? It's an interesting and an unexamined question. In the 8 decades since 1917, the United States has been in a state of all-out war for 17 years, or over 20% of the time. Since the founding of our nation, some 220 years ago, the United States has averaged a major war about every 25 years. And from the Civil War to the Spanish-American War, the United States has never gone more than 33 years without one. And that by not counting the constant warfare with the Indian nations in the West and other minor skirmishes. Finally, let me just say this. There was an ancient king in the Persian Empire in the 5th century BC by the name of Croesus, who amassed a considerable amount of wealth in his kingdom during his administration. He was showing off all his gold and good fortune to a visiting dignitary one day, who upon seeing it asked the king, "What good is all this gold if someone with better iron comes and takes it?" So far, no other nation or combination of nations on earth has spent and continues to spend so much gold for iron in the form of weapons than the United States. Has it given us any more real security? I'll leave you with that.
That was Joe Farah speaking on the economic costs of war. He spoke earlier this month at the annual Veterans for Peace Convention in San Francisco. Thanks to the LA Sound Posse for that recording. And thanks for listening to Unwelcome Guests. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. You can reach us through our website at www.unwelcomeguests.org. They'll take the money.